What would you say you have as far as assets under your company's management now?
So between all the multifamily properties, the total value is almost $100 million.
And your specific niche of real estate, how did that come to be?
We're the weird ones in real estate because we actually flip and wholesale and sell a finance and do creative finance with land, out of all things.
How do you ensure that you balance business with personal life for your wife and for your daughter?
So one thing we do is we do...
Welcome to Nursing Real Wealth today. I'm excited to host Jack Bosch, a story of immigrant success and ingenuity who transformed his life with a multi-million dollar land business. Jack is a real estate investor, financial expert, best-selling author, and the host of the Jack Bosch Show podcast. Alongside his wife, Michelle, he has flipped over 5,000 properties and developed the Forever Cash model, helping over 1,000 people become millionaires. Jack, welcome to the show. Glad to have you on.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. Well, let's kick the show off by starting a little and telling a little bit of your story of your move from Germany to the United States. About what, when did that happen, and what was sort of the impetus to come here?
So it happened 1997. So I'm here for quite a while now. It's 27 years to be exact. As a matter of fact, I just celebrated half of my life in the United States because I'm 54 now, and I came here at 27 and. Just as of August 18th, 2024, that's the date that I got here, August 18th, 1997. I'm officially 27 years here. And somewhere in the next couple of months is literally the time when I'm like spent, or pretty much that date is the date when I'm spending more than half of my life in the United States already. I'm from Germany. I came here. How do I came here? Why did I come here? Let me first say I'm happy here. I'm an American citizen now, but I never planned to be here. So I was in college. I was doing a master's. And in that last year, I had the opportunity to do a 10-month exchange program with an American university that other people I knew had gone to. It's a well-known partner. Well, the school is not well-known, but it's a partner university where every year a bunch of Germans from that college that I went to in Germany went there. So I was like, you know what? I need to improve my English. I wanted to do the German career. I wanted to do the nice corporate career. That was in my mind, nothing else, really box thinking, get a good education, get a good job, work until you're 65 and then retire and do a career on the way. So it's like, okay, gonna go up the career ladder. So that's my plan. So I subleased my apartment. I jumped on that because I realized in order to be even more attractive for German employers in a more and more international world, I need to speak better English. So my English was good enough to pass and go into college, but like really business English, it wasn't there. So I accepted, I went, I applied, I got accepted. I went to the US, never been to the US before, landed in Chicago. And this school was like Western Illinois University, middle of the road school, 5 hours away from Chicago. So I landed there, took a taxi to the Union Station, took a train, drove down, rode down there. Then one of the university people picked me up, brought me to a dorm. And then I spent 10 months there. But the thing is, during that process, I really started enjoying it in the United States. And then there's this little thing that happened that a few weeks into it, this young lady crosses my path. And I was like, ooh, who is that? And I was like, and so I meet her again a few weeks later. And then I invite her out to the date. And long story short, we're now married 23 years. And she's an immigrant from Honduras, Central America. So she came herself from another country. And so we decided both of us liked it here in the US and we wanted to give this relationship a chance. So it was like, you know what? If it works out, great. If it doesn't work out, it looks good on my resume to stay an extra year or two in the US. So I got a job because when you go to college, when you go to university for a year, you get an automatic work permit for 1 year in the US. And I think that's, at least back then, I think it's still the case. So I found a job that's willing to give me that job and then also potentially willing to sponsor my visa and help me all the way to the green card. But at that point, it's like, hey, let's see if this all works out. And so we moved to Chicago. Yes, it worked out. We as I said, we're married now. And so I never got back, never came back. I mean, we go every summer to visit family in Europe. Like my wife calls it our annual pilgrimage to Germany. we go visit my brother, his family, friends. This year, I spent 3 months in Europe just hanging out and took a sabbatical and just like spent time there. Walked 500 miles through Spain, did like a 500-mile walk, kind of like a spiritual pilgrimage in a way. Again, that word. But that's what it is. So that we decided to both stay here. So that's how it all started.
So it started off as an exchange program, and you ended up getting stuck here because you found your wife, you found love.
Love, and I mean, also I had never been to the U.S. and it is a wonderful country. I mean, it's like there's a lot of people right now, particularly in the election cycle. Every left bashes right, right bashes left. People talk about all this kind of stuff, but people don't forget that this is. Like you come into this country and you speak with an accent and people are just like, oh, where are you from? Oh, Germany. Oh, my God, my uncle thing. I'm 17th generation German or thing. And then like they're just everyone talks to everyone. You walk in a bar, you sit at the bar and immediately you start talking to people. Neighbors are friendly to each other. Usually, of course, only you have a good idea. And people are like, yeah, I love that idea. Yes, go for it. And it's this positive entrepreneurial atmosphere that I think has gone down a little bit since I moved here, but it's still way head and shoulders above the rest of the world. So guys, don't bash your own country. This is a beautiful country. This is a wonderful country. This is an incredibly affluent country. This is a very comfortable country. People are friendly. Restaurants are good. Transportation is good. Do we have problems in this country? Yes, as every other country has problems too. So just don't overlook that it is a great, great place to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree with that. And you're correct. Every election cycle, it seems to bring out the worst bashing of one side or the other. And, you know, there's so much to be grateful for in this country. So yeah, thank you for highlighting that. Along the way, obviously, you got started doing real estate and your specific niche of real estate. How did that come to be?
Yeah, so we're the weird ones in real estate because we actually flip and wholesale and sell a finance and do creative finance with land, out of all things. So people think land, like isn't land expensive and risky and so on and so forth? And it can be if you do it the wrong way. But people think about when they hear land is they think about the downtown Atlanta, downtown Phoenix, downtown LA, 2-acre lot that's worth $25 million and that somebody's going to buy to put a $500 million high rise on it. And if you do that during the wrong cycle of the economy, you can lose your shirt and that of a whole bunch of investors too. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is we focus on land, either little infill lots in residential areas, basically 35 houses, one empty lot. The houses are worth 400 grand. The lot is worth 100 grand. You get it for 60, sell it to a builder for 90, make $30,000. Do a quick wholesale. I'm talking about 2 to 5 acres out half an hour outside of town that somebody wants to live on and commute to the city. Somebody wants to retire on because the cost of living is cheaper. Somebody who just wants to buy and hold on it while the city moves around it and that goes up in value. And those lots are worth $50,000. You put them on a contract for 20, sell it to somebody for 40, make $20,000. We're talking about 20, 40, 80 acre lots 2 hours away from town that somebody with an RV, somebody with an ATV, somebody likes hunting, somebody likes the outdoors, would like to have their own mini ranch, their own place away from it all. And these lots are worth $100,000 or $50,000 to $250,000 typically. And you pick them up for 60 cents on a dollar and sell them for 80 cents on a dollar. So you take a $250,000 property, put it on a contract for $150,000, sell it for $210,000, make $60,000. That's what we're talking about. And you do that without even putting your own money into the deals by simply just putting on a contract and passing the deal on. Classic wholesaling, just with land. So how did we come across? So your question was, how did we get into that? Simply by not understanding the rest of real estate, by being complete novices to real estate. Like, I'm from Germany. In Germany, you build different. The walls are different. The structures is different. The electricity is 220. The standards are different. The roofs are differently constructed. The foundations, everything, the entire way of constructing is completely different. So I knew nothing about how much does it. Plus, nobody in my family has a real estate background. My wife's family doesn't have a real estate background. We knew nothing about how much does it take to rehab a kitchen or a bathroom or a house. Like, is it a $10,000 job or is it a $150,000 job? No idea. Couldn't tell you at the time. No freaking idea. So what we came across, though, is people that the next thing we looked at after not being able to figure that down, we got some deals under contract and we backed out because, again, we had no idea what to do with them or how to really deal with them and tried to wholesale them and we had estimated everything wrong. Next thing we stumble across people that haven't paid their properties where the owners had not paid property taxes. And so we're like, attended these auction, attended tax deed auction, tax lien auction. We're outbid on the tax deed auction. Bought some liens on the tax lien auction, but they were redeemed. They were paid off a few weeks later. It's like, okay, failure. Next thing we know, we then come up with a thought. And the thought was, if somebody doesn't pay their property taxes, what blew us away was the fact that there's even people who haven't paid their property taxes for years. Like, you know, in California, for example, if somebody, right now we're in 2024, if the state of California puts up, or a county puts up a few hundred properties for auction twice a year, once or twice a year, if they put up an auction right now in 2024, those people have stopped paying property taxes 6 years ago in 2018. So a thought came up, and the thought was, well, if those people don't want their properties anymore, didn't they decide that they don't want their properties anymore back in 2018? Well, there's nothing we can do about those anymore, but aren't there people who last week or last month or last year decided that they don't want their properties anymore, whose property are going to come up for auction in 2030, but nobody even knows about them? What if we go and figure out who those people are, get their names and contact information, send them a letter and see if they're not willing to sell us their property for cheap? Because if we get it right, if that thought is right, somewhere in there, these people should have said, well, I don't want it anymore. You can have it, state, give it away. And they're mentally ready to walk away from that property and get zero for it. So anything above zero should spike their interest, right? So we tried it. We went down to the county. Nowadays, you can actually tap into databases and at your fingertips pull that data like this. But back when we started, none of that existed. It was 20 years ago or so, 22 years ago. In 2002, we started with this. And we went to the county. We went to the tax collector and the assessor. And we got both of their lists because one of them has the mailing address. The other one has the tax information. So we combined those lists. And then we sent out some letters to the people that owe property taxes. And for whatever reason, only the landowners called us back. Nobody with a house called us back. But a bunch of people with lands are like, yeah, I've owned this land for 30 years. I don't want it anymore if you want it. And so we picked our first piece of land for $400 and sold it. Literally, we bought it, drove up there, put a sign on the property. The neighbor comes across from the street. He's like, what are you doing here? It's like, we're selling the property. He's like, great, I want to buy it. And he bought it on the spot for $4,000, which is only a $3,600 profit, but it's 10x our money. And it's a proof of concept. Because it doesn't really matter. It's like, we now teach this and I tell my students, first deal, of course, a $50,000 deal is better than a $5,000 deal, but don't focus on optimizing the deal. Just focus on making it through all the way through the deal because you're learning the steps and you're getting paid learning the steps. And even if you only get paid $5,000 for that first deal, who cares? Because guess what? After the third, fourth, fifth deal, it becomes so normal that you now learn how to do this at $50,000 and even $100,000 deals. Like, so, and why did we even start it in the first place? It's because we had jobs. Like, after graduating, we got those jobs and we were just miserable. Like, I didn't enjoy it. I had a job that I had 100% travel. I left Monday morning at five in the morning. I got in the car, went to the airport that had a 7 o'clock flight, flew somewhere an hour or two away, like from Chicago to Detroit, or when we moved to Phoenix, we flew to LA or to Colorado. and basically walked into an office at 10 o'clock at a customer site because I was at a software company with software implementation. And I'm not even a software guy. I was more like in the business development and business and a business analyst. I was a business analyst for them. So I still had to learn the software. I didn't enjoy it. I didn't like it, but I took the job because it's the only job I could get that would sponsor my visa. And I basically bit the bullet. And I was like, sometimes in life, you have to do what you have to do in order to bring your family forward, in order to accomplish the things that in life that you want to accomplish. And in this case, I didn't want that job. My career ambitions were in a completely different field. But I was like, if I want to have a chance with this young lady, if I want to have a chance to stay in this United States, then I got to take the job that is willing to pay me a green card, whether I like it or not. And I got to bite the bullet and see it through all the way to the end. And in this case, it took 5.5 freaking years to get this done. But after 5.5 years, I had the green card. But 2 years into it, we were so miserable because we love being together. And in this case, I was 100% separate. I was 100% travel, that we basically started looking around and started. The plan was to create a plan, find something that we can build up while the job pays the bills and while the job gets us the green card, we can build up something. And then when the green card hits, we can quit that job and we can go full time here. And that's what we've done. And that's what I also recommend to our students right now. Don't quit your job right away, unless you have a bunch of money on the sideline that can pay your bills for the next year or something like that. Don't quit your job right away. Build this part time. So that once you then have built $50,000, $100,000, $200,000 in profits, you now have the confidence and the proof of concept and the deals under your belt that you can say, you know what, I need to quit my job because my job is taking up 8 hours producing $75,000 a year. And this one is taking 10 hours a week, 8 hours a day. And this one is taking 40 hours a week. And this one is taking 10 hours a day. And with 10 hours, let me say that again. This job takes me 40 hours a week and produces 75K a year. This one takes me 10 hours a week and it's producing $200,000 a year. This is costing me money. If I can just double my time over here and have a part-time job, I can do much more. Like one of our students right now started in January, and by July, he is at $300,000 and $289,000 in profits. And working from 9 in the morning till 1 in the afternoon on this business.
You know, I was just looking up a statistic I recall, but yeah, 60% of people report being emotionally detached at work, and with 19% of those folks reporting that they feel completely miserable. Yeah. So there's a small margin of people that enjoy their job, but there's a lot that don't. You know, what would be your message to people that have that misery but are afraid to take the leap into something like this because they're like, I don't know what I'm doing, you know? I don't feel like I'm equipped to do that.
The first one, understand that it's normal to not know what you're doing. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't have the first clue. So the first thing is go get yourself educated about what's even possible. Learn the terminology. Heck, I didn't know what a 2x4 was when I started. Like 2x4 what? 2x4 inches? A square thing until I understood these are the wooden sticks that they used to build houses. I didn't know what drywall was. I thought the word deed had to do with church because the church, they tell you to do good deeds, not bad deeds. Right? So like I had not even coming from another country with English as your second language, first you got to learn like day-to-day English. Like what do neighbors to say to each other? Because school English doesn't teach you that. Right. Then I had to learn business English because I was getting thrown into this business world where I had to learn. I was having a headache every single night because I was just trying to catch up and like learning technology language, business language, and this kind of stuff. And now you get into real estate and it's a completely new field. And I knew nothing of the terminology of real estate. Like what's a title company? Like what's a phase one environmental test? What's a perk test? What does even percolation mean, right? So like, what do you, now I have all these answers. Of course, now it's second nature. We've done 5,000 deals. So be aware that this is the most normal thing in the world is to not know anything. And then first of all, educate yourself, but then also understand that if you don't do anything about being miserable, you're going to be in the exact freaking same position a year from now, and nothing's going to have changed. So turn off Netflix, turn off the reels on Facebook and Instagram and things like that, and just spend half an hour a day while driving to work or not driving to work, listen to a real estate program, to a real estate podcast, to a real estate things, and start learning the freaking language. The next thing is start looking what the options are. Like, you started a while ago and now you found your niche in the private lending industry, right? People don't even know that. Many people don't even know that industry exists. Most people don't know land exists. Most people have never heard about it. Like, I've been screaming it off the rooftops for 16 years, and still 90% of real estate investors don't even have a clue about what we do here. So look at different options. See which of those you mesh with best, which of those you align with the most. Somebody wants to really see things being built. Somebody's really excited by remodel projects, the before and after, and getting their hands dirty, and is this crafts person. You wouldn't find me close to a hammer if my life depended on it. Right? I'm just not interested in hammers. I like my, like, I literally, in our house, if we have, let's say we buy a painting or so, or a mirror, we buy a new mirror. I hire a guy to come in to hang the mirror up. Not because I'm too good to it or anything like that. No, forget that. I'm like, I'm just like everyone else. It's because I suck at it. Like, I can put that mirror up straight, but once you take it off, you'll find 15 holes in the back. Because until I got it right, I probably had to drill 15 holes into that thing. Versus a skilled person comes in like boom, boom, boom. So fix and flip is not my thing. I will never be happy with it. I don't want to deal with contractors. I don't want to deal with the city. I don't want to deal with Home Depot. I don't want to deal with theft. I don't want to deal with people that don't show up. I don't want to deal with any of that stuff. But land flipping, I can do from home. I can do by simply optimizing a couple of business systems. I don't ever have to see the property. I don't have to meet with the seller in person. Sometimes you have a phone call with the seller. I don't have to meet with a buyer. I can literally run this from anywhere from my home. So for me, given that I also had a job with 100% travel, it was the perfect fit that we stumbled into.
Awesome. Yeah. No, that's fantastic. And I don't know as much about land as I probably should as well, you know, but I've got a few friends that do land, and it does have, you know, a lot of perks. You know, we, as private money lenders, we're always evaluating the current condition of the house. And there's so many different variables that, you know, I mean, certainly with land, you got to care about floodplains and things like that. But there's a little bit less, you know, that needs to be considered there for sure. So,
and you have to consider it more. For example, if you lend on land, you have completely different consideration than if you just wholesale it. Like, I don't care if there's a floodplain on it. If I can get the $50,000 piece of land on a contract for 20 grand and I can sell it for 40 again or to somebody else, they do the analysis. And as long as they come up with a reasonable, if they come to the conclusion that land fulfills all the criteria that they need for it to fulfill, then they're going to buy it. I just got it cheaper because I'm dealing with people that don't want it anymore. By the way, we no longer deal with tax delinquent people. That's only how we got into it. We very quickly realized that there is 100x more people that still pay their property taxes every year, but they're just not interested in the property anymore. They're grudgingly paying the property taxes. They're getting the property bill, tax bill, and they're like, oh man, every year I have to pay $2,500 for this thing. I haven't even gone out there for 20 years. Oh, well, one of these days we just need to sell that thing or get rid of it. But okay, I'll pay it one more year. And they write a check and they send it in. And that's how they, or they send a wire or whatever, they pay it online. And that's how it is. But now when we contact them, they're like, oh my God, hallelujah. Yes, where have you been all my life? I want to get rid of this property. Yes, I don't need full price on it because I just want to make the $2,500 a year stop from having to go up.
Yeah, yeah. So just shifting your marketing plan, what's the biggest shift there to go and finding those kinds of people versus tax delinquent? Tax delinquent kind of makes sense. You go to a county recorder, but how do you find a person that's motivated but isn't delinquent, doesn't have any of those other triggers.
Yeah. So the at the beginning, what we did is we just looked at where is our typical seller, what do they have in common? And what they had in common is that they either inherited the property, which means they actually counterintuitively owned it for usually a very short period of time. They owned it for like a couple of years only, which you would think that somebody owns a property for a couple of years is not interested because they just bought it. But in many cases, they haven't bought it. They actually inherited it. So it went to their ownership. They're in the new owner, but they didn't buy it. The second group is the exact opposite. Those that were that own the properties for 30 years or so, 10 plus years, but usually 20, 30 is like a really 40 years is like beautiful. And because often they actually have either they're older and they're not interested anymore, their kids don't want it, or they even have passed away, but the kids have never put the property into their own name. The kids don't want to pay for probate. The kids really don't know they can't do anything with this property until they put it in their own name. And they don't want to spend a dollar on it. So you can literally get those for like a few hundred bucks. Plus, you cover the cost of probate, which then might take you, depending on which state you do it in, then it probate might cost you a few hundred dollars or a couple of thousand dollars. So it might add, let's say, a couple of thousand dollars to the purchase price. But if that property is worth $25,000 and you offer them $500 plus probate costs, you're in it for $2,500 plus closing, plus perhaps $3,000 you're into the deal. Is that a good deal to get a $25,000 property for $3,000 all day long? And what you do with those properties, by the way, you actually don't wholesale them. You don't put them up for $15,000 and then make $12,000 in the process. What you do with those, you market them up to like $27,000, ask for a $4,000 down payment, and then finance the rest, let them pay the rest in monthly payments.
Because you just paid off your principal, your money into it, and now you're just cash flowing for years to come.
Exactly. You have $3,000 in the deal, but you get a $4,000 down payment. So you already got your money back plus $1,000 in the pocket. And now you get something like $300-$400 a month for the next 10 years or so.
Sweet. Exactly. Yeah, that's awesome. That's a great model.
Yeah. So we found that, what else? We found that a lot of sellers live out of state. Right. And that's the beginning. Now, though, we have a software, we have a CRM software that's integrated with a data service that actually one of our students created that. I just interviewed him on my podcast, The Jack Bosch Show. And it's literally integrated into our software. So you can now do what you do is you pull the data that we typically recommend, and then you upload it to their software. They charge you a little bit for it. And they go through it and add all kinds of additional data to it. They aggregate and the data, give it a score. For example, they have data of that. Is this owner unemployed? Has this owner have bad credit? Does this owner just went from good credit to bad credit? Does this owner have 25, 30 different additional demographic and socioeconomic characteristics that they cross-track for that owner, and then they come up with a score. I mean, you think about it. If somebody just had a bankruptcy or somebody had a foreclosure and somebody's credit just went down and somebody just got unemployed, are they more likely to need money and are willing to sell that piece of land for cheap? Yeah. So we have basically enriched. We now have the ability to enrich the data through our software. Our software is already integrated to the biggest data source in the U.S. So our students can go in, pull the data, then send it to the other guy, get a score on it, and then just say, everyone with that score and above, we're sending a direct mail piece, and now they're getting the best of the best leads to respond.
For sure. Wow. Wow. Have you explored that with with houses as well?
2014 or so, I started flipping a few houses, and we actually even wholesaled one. I think we even rehabbed one. Then I realized it's too much hassle. I want to go back to my number one love, which is land. There is 46 million pieces of land in the United States, and I would estimate there's perhaps 3,000 people doing land flipping in any significant way. So there's 3,000 counties in the United States alone, 3,007. Which means that on average, there's one investor per county. And in the house world, there's probably 3,000 a county. I don't know, I'm making this up, but there's like way more, 500x more competition in the house world than the land world. I just pulled out of there, just didn't want to deal with that.
Wow. I was just thinking in terms of like, you know, that could become a proprietary product that you guys could offer that, you know, if you could get AI to go and scrub that automatically and
piece it together actually, with the,
yeah.
It's actually a friend of mine that actually, one of our students that actually created that. It is a, they offer that as a service, that kind of data enriching for houses too. We just only use the land portion of it for us, but we contract it with them. So when I do land deals, I run it through his database, I pay him. When our students come in and they use our software, they have to pay him like a few, not much, it's super cheap, but basically they have a subscription with this guy. But we have fully integrated into our CRM software that we have created that our students can also create. But it's a third-party service that we don't own. So, yeah.
Wow. Wow. That's awesome. Moving on a little bit to, you know, kind of your training program that you have. You've developed the Forever Cash model that helps has helped multiple people achieve financial freedom. Can you just explain to me the central tenets of the model and how it differs from maybe some other strategies out there?
Yeah, back like 11 years ago, I wrote a book called Forever Cash. Currently out of print. You can buy secondhand copies on Amazon still. We need to bring it back on market some point of time. I just need to write version 2.0 and read, and I haven't had the time to go over it. But there's not going to be much difference in the books because the premises behind it is the same. And the premise behind it is that there is a clear formula to win financially in life. I didn't know that formula when I came here. My dad's a middle school teacher, a high school teacher, retired. My mom's a stay-at-home mom. My wife's mother is an elementary school teacher, retired. Her dad passed away when she was 9 months old. None of our respective families was an entrepreneur. None of our respective families was rich, or is rich. So we did not grow up in an environment or a family where wealth principles were being taught. Yet now we own almost 1,000 apartments. We own multifamily. We own single family properties. We own commercial properties. We have built a pretty nice portfolio that is actually could be considered if generational wealth that's going to be passed on to the next generation, to our daughter, and so on and so forth. So how did that happen? Well, we realized that there's essentially three kinds of cash that we talk about. And there's kind of three kinds of way. A dollar is not a dollar is not a dollar. How you make that dollar and where that dollar comes from plays a huge role. What most people are trained on, and I almost want to say like brainwashed on, and taught, and nobody tells you any other different way, everyone says hey, this is the way to go, is to work for what we call one-time cash. One-time cash basically means that you work for it one time and you get paid for it one time, otherwise known as a job. But also wholesaling, like even land flipping is one-time cash. So like, but it's a different quality. So within, it's not bad to do this. It's just you got to understand it, what it does. And you got to understand that one is never going to be able to retire off one-time cash. Now, what I mean by that is very simple. If you have a job, you get paid. You work 40 hours, you get paid 40 hours. You stop working, you stop getting paid. It's a definition of one-time cash. If you do a deal, there's different qualities of one-time cash. There's you can work at McDonald's for $10 an hour and you work 5 hours, you get $50, right? Or you can work and do a land flip and make $20,000 in one deal. It's obviously the better use of your money, better use of your time, because you work 10 hours on that deal, you make $20,000, it's a $2,000 an hour hourly rate. And by the way, this is not out of the blue, this exists. Like one of our students just made $1 million on one deal. So it's the exception though. I'm not promising anything here. So with that said, so if you ever stop wholesaling, if you ever stop and you drop, your income stops. So what people have been trained to do is like, go work like that, put money on the side. And then when you retire, you hope that the mountain of money you have is tall enough to outlive you, plus a little bit social security. Well, there's better ways than that. The second best way to do this thing is actually your area. It's great. It's second cash is what we call temporary cash. Temporary cash is when you work for it once and you get paid for it again and again and again, but it does end at some point of time. So in other words, private lending is a great temporary cash source. You lend the money once, the money comes back plus interest, but eventually it stops at some point of time. Because then you get the money back and you relend it and so on and so forth. So you have to rebuild it again and again, and that's good. Or seller financing deals, like that deal that we just talked about. Sell it for $27, $4,000 down, but you have it under three. You got all your money back. Now this is profit, it's cash flow. You do $300 a month. You do 30 deals like that, you got $9,000 a month coming into your bank account. That's $108,000 a year. Great, you put your feet up, you're retired until those loans come to an end, right? So that leads us to the third kind of category. And the third category is what we call forever cash, thus the name of the book, forever cash. Forever cash is when you work for it once and you get paid for it forever. Doesn't mean it's passive, but you work for it once and you get paid for it forever. It can be relatively passive, but it usually there's a little bit of management involved. And that's, again, real estate. So what I mean by that, and basically that's now owning an apartment building that spits out. We have an apartment building that spits out six figures a year to us, and my involvement is 20 minutes a week, once a week, and 2-3 times a year I fly over there and look at the property. That's my involvement. If something happens, I might get involved for a couple more hours or an afternoon here and there if I need to make some bigger decisions, but that's it. It's about as passive as it gets, very limited involvement. The problem is an apartment complex like that, you need $2 million to invest in that deal, Brad, for you to be able to get a $5 million loan and buy a $7 million apartment complex. And most people don't have that, and I didn't have that. So how do you get there? You start by building a cash machine, and the cash machine is usually a one-time cash machine. So there's nothing wrong with one-time cash. It's just you need to understand that it's there because it is a means to an end. So land flipping produces the cash that we then use to the cash and cash flow from seller financing, and we use the cash and the cash flow to the goal of that money is not for me to buy a Ferrari with it, which I don't own, just for the record. The goal of that is not for me to own something like that. The goal is to take that money and use as much as possible from it and roll that over into a forever cash asset. And have that forever cash asset have more and more in those, and they're like spigots of water that come out, and you have one that spits out cash. And soon enough, you have a second one that spits out cash. And soon enough, you have a third one. Multiple streams of income is another word for it. And soon enough, if they're properly set up and they're forever cash assets, you got more income coming in from that than you actually have in your job. You're out of the rat race. You can retire and you have your freedom back. You have your time back. Now you can use that time to either do more or lay on the couch. But every single month, your bills are being paid by these semi-passive but forever cash income sources that come to you. The concept of the book, that's the wealth. That's how the wealthy create wealth. If you look at it in Europe, there's still aristocrats. I'm from Germany. In my neighborhood, there's a Graf von Bodman, which is the Count of Bodman. Bodman is a little town, and the Count has a little castle there. It's really more like a big mansion. It doesn't look like a castle. And with a garden around it and a big gate around it. And this dude owns 60% of all the land in the surrounding circle, like a couple of square miles around. And he has it all rented out to farmers that grow apples on it and grow strawberries and things like that. So what is he? Truly the landlord. Right? How does he maintain his lifestyle with his servant and his things that he actually has? By actually owning, he owns a bunch of houses, rental houses. He owns a bunch of apartments there. He owns a land. And all of that is income. And he spends a few hours a day managing his estate. Now, we need to learn from those people. Those are the wealthy people. And he has been wealthy for generations. Right? The current count, the old count is still alive, but the younger one is my age. I actually went to school with him for a couple of years. He was a year or two older than I was. I know briefly, kind of know the guy a little bit. He's not smarter than I am. He's not smarter than you are. He's not smarter than any of us. He just learned that you don't spend earned money. You invest earned money. Earned money is there to be put either into your own education or into assets that spit out more money over time. And if you understand this to your core, then you look at your paycheck a different way. You look at your paycheck as the seedling for future forever cash assets and no longer as the money you go blow on the weekend in Vegas.
I love it. Yeah. So don't spend earned income, invest earned income. Right. So you can get forever income.
And nothing wrong with the weekend in Vegas. We just went to see Bruno Mars in Vegas. And I'm not a gambler, but we had beautiful dinners and things like that. But guess what? These tickets were like expensive. Like, let's say this weekend cost a couple of thousand dollars. That couple of thousand dollars came from the cash flow from these properties. And if you burn that, guess what happens next month? More cash flow is there. There's nothing wrong with having fun, but just use your passive income from the forever cash assets for the fun stuff. Use your earned income to fuel that other income.
I love that. Yeah. We've got a component of that even in our lending business. You know, obviously with us, we're lending short-term capital primarily, which is the one-time cash, as you said, but then we're also raising capital we're able to go and fund sort of like a cheap debt option for people that are buying more expensive assets, valuable assets like multifamily, RV parks, things like that, where we'll fund maybe their CapEx expense. And it'll be a cheap debt, maybe 10 to 12% interest, which we don't really make much money on. But the back end, what we get on the back end is as a portion of equity. So we're working to get kind of inject ourselves in there. So between us and our capital partners, we'll take a slice of the equity forever in that.
Beautiful. Yeah, exactly. That's a great way. And there's so many creative ways to make that happen. We just stumbled into land flipping and to getting these lots for 10 to 50 cents on a dollar, which is huge discounts, of course, turn around, make nice cash checks. Also sell them with self-financing, great cash flow, and then take those two things. And yes, we quit our jobs, and then part of that needed to maintain our lifestyle. But we stayed in our starter home. Back in 2001, I bought a $151,000 three-bedroom, two-bath starter home. We stayed in that house all the way till 2007 when we upgraded to a beautiful 4,500-square-foot home. But all through that, it took us 18 months to become millionaires. We were multi-millionaires already staying in that little house because we didn't let our expenses go up. Instead, we used the money to invest. We used that money to buy houses when the market crashed in 2009. We used that money to educate ourselves. We didn't use that money to buy expensive cars and things like that. Now I do drive a 911, like a Porsche 911, not a Ferrari. I'm not a Ferrari guy, but I do. Now I have the nice sports car. Now we have four cars. Now we have a 7,000-square-foot home. Now we have all these things, but they came with delayed gratification, which is such a hard thing for people nowadays to understand, because in the world of TikTok and Instagram, they want it all today. And that's not the smart way of doing it. You got to put your head down, build it up, stay low, keep your expenses low, invest in yourself and your education, invest in more assets, and then boom, all of a sudden you come exploding out of the gate and you live the life for the rest of your life that most other people can't live.
Exactly. And piece this timeline together for me again. You started doing the land in what year?
So we started dabbling with the first successful deal happened in June of 2002. That was actually a tax delinquent deal that happened on the sideline. Wasn't even using our exact strategy. Then the real first land deal happened in, I think, March. Using this exact strategy happened in March of 2003. And by October of 2003, 17th of October, I quit my job. By that, the green card had arrived and we were finishing a project. I left this in good standing because I mean, that's just, you want to leave things in good standing. You don't want to just say like, screw you guys, I'm gone. I was on a software project. I went to my boss and said like, hey, listen, I've been doing this on the side. It's now can be full time. I got my green card. How much time do you need me to give you in order to quit? And it's like, well, we have about 5 weeks to go, 4 to 5 weeks. Why don't you give us that, finish the project with us. And then he's like, sure, because I'm not going to another employer. There's nobody else waiting for me. It doesn't matter if I take this a little longer or not. So basically, I quit. October 17th was my last day at work, 2003. By 8 months later, 8 to 10 months later, by summer of 2004, we broke the $1 million mark. Because what we did is not sit back afterwards. We basically said, now I got 50 hours a week that I wasn't able to put into this. And my wife has 50 hours a week that she hadn't been able to put into this. Let's put both of us 50 hours a week into that and really grow this very, very quickly. And again, a few months later, we were millionaires, or 8 months later. So we were millionaires. And then 2 years later, we had broken the eight-figure mark. And then a couple of years later, 2009 happened, which was America was for sale. And we were able to start buying assets like crazy. We were buying rent houses, and then we transitioned into, we added multifamily to it. And then 2008, we added coaching to it. So we started teaching people what we do, because nobody was doing this in the country. And with the housing market going down, people were losing their shirt, but our strategy continued working. Prices went down. So we went from making $40,000 on a deal to perhaps only making $18,000 on a deal, because you buy cheaper, sell it cheaper. But the strategy continued to work. So we cruised to the crisis while a lot of people lost their shirt. And we basically started teaching it, and a lot of people, and ever since we've been teaching this, and now we have created over 1,000 people that have themselves created $1 million or more in profits.
That's fantastic. So literally started with almost no assets really in 2002. 2007 is when you allowed yourself to have at least a little bit of an upgrade, but otherwise 5 years of delayed gratification until that point.
We drove a 10-year, at some point of time, we sold our second car to keep costs down, and we drove an 8-year-old Geo Prism, which is like a Toyota Corolla, just a tiny thing. And then one day I wasn't paying attention, and I rear-ended somebody on that car at like 5 miles an hour or so at the stoplight. But it was enough to basically total this little car, because it was nothing. And at that point of time, like 2006 or 2007, we then upgraded to a used BMW X5. That's the first nice car we had. So yeah, for 4 to 5 years, complete delayed gratification, just put our heads down and just start doing these deals. And of course, we took some time off, and perhaps we splurged on a nice hotel and a nice dinner here and there. I mean, obviously, you want to reward yourself, but not the big, like, let's take $1 million and buy a $1 million home. Let's not buy the five cars and things like that. None of that, of that matter. We just kept it low. And then once we saw, man, this is sustainable, this is really, now we reached a certain level, we took a small portion of that and then upgraded our lifestyle.
Absolutely, yeah. And so fast forward to today, what would you say you have as far as assets under your company's management now?
So between all the multifamily properties, the total value is almost $100 million.
That's fantastic. Yeah. That's fantastic. Yeah.
Some of them are syndications with other investors in and so on and so forth, but it's almost $100 million. Yeah.
Wow. And you built that in 22 years?
Yes.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Wow. Beyond land flipping, I do want to talk just a little bit. You said you expanded into the multifamily arena and some single family as well. What would you say your balance is between those two? Do you have more multifamily or more single family, and why?
I have 6 multifamilies right now, with anywhere between, the smallest one is 45 units, the largest one of 258 units. And we only have 20 rental houses left, of which 5 we're selling right now, and then we'll keep 15 of those. Simply, rental houses are harder to manage. Particularly if you buy, what probably the one mistake I made back in 2009, 10, 11, was I bought too old of a product. So I bought properties, usually they were built in the 1950s, because they have brick walls and things like that. We didn't know what happened in 2009. We thought the world coming to an end. We thought like we might get into this 10-year-old depression and recession or something like that. And so I bought brick-built homes that families could double up on, and they did for a while as the economy was really bad. two families moved in together into a 4 or 5 bedroom brick home that we bought for $50,000. But had I paid $70,000, because prices were so low, had I paid $70,000, I could have gotten a nice stick-built home in the suburbs. So, and that was 2 years old or 5 years old, right? So with that comes what the downside of that is, these older homes, they have over time bigger repairs coming up. Like the first home that we bought in 2001 is a rental house. I never have to do anything on that house. It's just like, it's in perfect condition. It's now a 23-year-old house. It's like I needed to, the shingles are concrete shingles, and the water heater needed to be replaced, and the air conditioner needed to be replaced. And other than that, it's in perfect condition. Those other houses don't. So what happens is, in some of these markets, over time, the value of these houses went up, but the cash flow was horrible. So we just simply, every time, let's say we had 17 houses in Cleveland, already sold them, but last year, a couple of years ago, we sold them all. But these 17 houses in Cleveland, they would be rented at an average of $1,000 a month. That's $17,000 a month, minus like some smaller repairs and things like that. But every freaking single month, a furnace or something went out and it cost us 10 grand, right? Or water leak happened in the basement and it cost 20 grand. And we literally made no cash flow on these properties. So after trying that for a bunch of years, we're like, you know what, let's sell those things. And we sold them. Luckily, they had doubled or tripled in value. So we made money on the appreciation, which was predictable because we bought them so cheap. Eventually, they have to catch up. So we sold them and we rolled that money over into other things. But on the multifamily side, and then here's the thing. Every time a repair like that comes up, who is the decision maker? I am, right? You are. Because while we had a property management company in place, they have usually a residential property management company. You have an agreement that they decide on everything that's $500 or less. Or if you want to put it up, you can say like you decide on everything that's $1,000 or less. But a new furnace, a water leak, all these kind of things, foundation issues, when that stuff happens, it's $20,000. They're not going to decide on that. They're going to send you one. Now then, are you going to? So it just involved so much work and I had to be involved all the time that it just was not fun. So we sold them. The nice part of a lot larger multifamily, particularly like 70 units and up, is though that you have a leasing manager, a maintenance person, a regional officer, and then between those, they figure out everything. And then once a week, you just meet with them for 30 minutes and they let you know about the bigger stuff and you solve it. But they get three quotes. They get all these different things going. And you really don't have to do a whole lot at all on these properties other than give direction of what your vision is for the property. So we are basically slowly getting rid of all of our single families and continue to move all of that into multifamily because it's just easier to manage. And there's another reason for it, very important reason. In single families, you're not in control of the property value. In multifamily, you are. Because single family, it doesn't matter if you have golden toilets and golden faucets and golden floors and a gold, like the house is worth what similar houses in the neighborhood have sold in the last 90 days. A multifamily, on the contrary, if you double income, you doubled the value of the property. So in multifamily, the value of the property is a direct result of the income because it's basically calculated based on the concept of a cap rate, which basically one way to explain a cap rate, it's a multiple of income. So 5 cap means that you basically, that for every dollar that you increase the income, you're creating $20 in additional value on the property. So if you can create $100,000 more income, you created $2 million more value in the property. And that you can be in control of by doing upgrades, by running the property a certain way, by building a community. And we have just gotten better of that. But the reason why we got into that is the forever cash, because we started realizing like we love our land deals. We'll do land deals forever. We love the cash flow from it. But as I'm 54 now, what if I'm 64? What if I'm 74? At some point of time, I probably will stop doing land flips eventually. Eventually, I want to just basically sit back a little bit. And you cannot do that if you only work for active income. But you can do it if you build up these assets and they're well managed.
Yeah. You've been you've been very successful in educating, as you said. You know, there's been over 1,000 people, you know, that have been able to succeed at making, you know, $1 million in their own businesses. How important would you say is community and mentorship in achieving real estate success?
Huge. It's huge. I mean, the numbers are clearly out there. I mean, I said, right, out of 10 people buying, out of 100 people buying a home study course, 50 don't even open it. 40 don't go through more than 2 or 3 modules, and 10% take it all the way to the end. And out of those, probably only half take action. That changes dramatically if you can take, and the numbers are higher when you're in a coaching program, but much higher, of course. And particularly we have actually taken this to about 4 times the industry average is our success rate. So in other words, everyone, like I would think like 95% of the people that really want to have success with our program. Now, why is that? Because of exactly what you said. It's all about community. It's all about accountability. It's all about making sure that people actually have that support. Because if people would have a history of like, why do we go to school? Right? Because why do we send our kids to school? Why do we say like, hey, the internet is there. You can educate yourself on everything you want. What would happen? Would people know how to read? No, they wouldn't. Half of the people wouldn't know how to read because there's no guidance. There's no community. There's no accountability. Right? Why do people then afterwards, why do the best, even NFL season starting again? Like why does the NFL even need coaches? There are 53 of the best players in the entire United States, in the entire world for that matter. They're pulling in from all over the world. They already know how to play the game. Why do they need a coach? Because the coach puts it all together, creates a community, creates the accountability, creates the plan, creates the execution thing, puts them so that you can accomplish more than you thought you could accomplish on your own. It's the same thing, just we don't call them coaches. We call them coaches in sport. We don't call them coaches in school. We call them teachers. You go to university. Like somebody could say, like, everything there is in math has already been figured out. Why do I need to go to college and learn math if I want to be a mathematician? I could just learn. No, well, you learn, but it takes you 10 times as long. You don't, if you don't understand something, you don't have anywhere to go to ask the question. You have a situation that you've never seen. You don't have anyone to go to that already has seen it and then can basically make that deal happen. The deal falls apart. You don't know how to put it back together. But if you are in a community, if you are in a coaching environment, and particularly in one that has coaches that actually have done hundreds of deals themselves, like in our case, our average coach, no, all our coaches have gone through a coaching program. They're all 100% full-time land flippers, pulling in hundreds of thousands of dollars, some of them even 7 figures on their own. And they're contributing their coaching services back into the community to help the next generation up. And they're doing group coaching and one-on-one coaching and the community. And we're doing mindset sessions. And so we really looked at that and it's like, if I want to build the perfect program, what would I want to have in the program? That's how we set it up. And that's why our success rate is so high. But without it, what we see is can people succeed on their own? Absolutely. Can succeed on their own. Just usually takes them 5 times as long. The success scale goes like this, and they're losing. And I mean, a whole bunch of the people that have been successful on their own came back to me and says like, Jack, if I know what I know today, I would have paid for coaching 10 times over because between deals that fell apart, between time delays, between it just overall taking much longer, and between mistakes that I made, I would have paid for coaching 10 times over.
Right, exactly. And I can attest to that myself. You know, I'm a member of Pace Morby's community. I'm in the Gator and the Sub 2 communities. That's where I met my partner. And that's where I met so many people inside of my own network who have.
Pace is a good friend of mine.
What's that?
And Pace is a friend of mine. We all know each other.
Yeah. No, he's a fantastic guy. He's an incredible mentor. And the community is fantastic, too. I think the community is just almost as big and as important as the mentorship itself, if not even more to a certain extent, because, you know, one mentor can't possibly reach every single soul, you know, but many different people in the community can work with one another. And there's lots of people in the community that are experts in their own right who can help you, just as you said, piecemeal a deal together. We've got an incredible network of private money lenders that we're connected with now because of the community. And it's accelerated my growth from the time that I narrowed down on that niche and decided this is where I'm going. You know, the acceleration for my growth is exponential because of community.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, absolutely. I would encourage anybody who's listening, if you are on the edge and you're thinking about getting into real estate, definitely consider investing in mentorship and community for sure.
Yeah.
Your role, well, let me phrase it a different way. What role has your partnership with your wife, Michelle, played in your success? And how do you ensure that you balance business with personal life for your family, for your wife and for your daughter?
So the first part of the question is easy to answer. The second one is harder. The first one is huge impact. Like, I mean, Dave Ramsey said that I like what Dave has to say, but I'm not a big fan of like just being totally debt-free. Debt-free has their space. Like currently we're paying off a lot of the debt that we do have created because we're entering a little bit of a different phase in our lives. So you're paying this off and in order to have assets free and clear, and that's a beautiful thing that you sleep really beautifully at night. But back to the question is, many people say that if you have your spouse, male or female, can be your biggest success turbocharger or your success package. Because if your spouse does not want you to be doing what you're doing, life becomes living hell. Because you hear it every single day. It's like, what are you doing? Why are you not here? Come on, don't spend so much time on here. What are you doing? It's not good. It's a constant moral beatdown. If that's what you're living with, then it is hard. I'm not going to do any kind of recommendation of things. It's not my place to make any of that. I've been blessed. Michelle and I started both with nothing. I always like to say that people are like, oh, you're financially successful. What if you get divorced? Well, hopefully not, knock on wood, right? But if we did, there's no such thing like my business or her business. It's our business, and she has 50% of it because we built this thing together from A to Z. And I've said this on podcasts. It's in writing here, literally on video. So it's like, because there's no such thing like, oh, no, like prenup. Prenup over what? Two suitcases? Like there's no prenup that we had to sign. So we have joint bank accounts. We talk, everyone has access to everything. Everyone has access to each other's phones, right? We know each other's passwords. We don't have secrets from each other. And we are financially 100% aligned to make with the same goals of what we want, including right now, a little bit of the payoff debt and slowing down and simplifying and living like, yes, just overall slowing down our life, speed of life a little bit. How do you keep, the second part of the question is a hard one. Once you run a business together as a spouse and as a team of husband, wife, or like spouse or two partner business to live together partners, if you want to do this gender neutral here, it's hard. It's hard. Business takes over. You talk about business from the moment you wake up till the moment you fall asleep. And it's really dangerous to not lose your personal connection over it. So one thing we do is we do, and we're not immune to that. We have our ups and downs in that. The first thing is you have to be committed to each other to thick or thin, no matter what. Like if you have that, like when I'm married, I know marry only once. That's it. The second thing is though, you need to make space for these other things. So we take several weeks every summer and we travel to Europe, and that's more or less a work-free zone, right? Or we go for a month to Hawaii, and yes, I work from there. Sometimes I get up at 5 in the morning and sit from 6:30 on the balcony in the lanai, as it's called, and work from 6:30 to like 9:30, and then I've worked 4 hours, and then I say like, okay, that's enough, and then we go surfing, or we go swimming, or we go explore the island, or we go hiking, and And in that, we don't talk about business. And sometimes it slips in, but we make this purpose. Once a week, at least once a week, sometimes more often, we're going on a, my calendar is blocked out usually on Wednesdays because we're going for lunch together. Simply go for lunch and go for coffee afterwards and hang out. And we live in Phoenix, so it's 110 degrees in summer. So we perhaps in summer go to the mall. In winter, we go for lunch and go for a walk or something like that. And just make sure those things. And then we plan little vacations as we can. And just try like Bruno Mars in Vegas and other kind of things. And just you got to plan for that, because otherwise business can be all consuming. And that's not healthy. So, but it's not easy to do that, but you can, and you need to be aware of it. And now we're in the particular situation. Our daughter is turning 17. And so she's a junior in high school. So she only has like a year, not even 2 years left before she's gone to college, at which point even the third person in the family that we talk about with and so on is going to be gone. It's only the two of us. So then it becomes even more important to have established something else that is not just business. So we're actively seeing that. We're knowing it's happening. So we need to prepare for that ahead of time already.
Yeah. I like how Ryan Pineda structures his life. And my partner actually puts it this way. He's like, you know, when you fill up a jar with rocks and water, you fill it up with rocks first, then fill it up with water. You don't fill it up with water, then fill it up with rocks. The water will spill all over and make a mess. He's like, so in life, you know, you want to make sure that you fill up, you establish your rocks, and then you fill in around that. So when it comes to your family and your spouse and things like that, you establish your rocks as a spouse, as a married couple, as a family. And then you fill in work around that, not work, then family. I think that's a really wise way to put it. And it's essentially what you're doing when you block out like Wednesday for your wife specifically. That's that immovable rock that, you know, keeps that relationship strong. So that's fantastic. Jack, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show. I really appreciate you coming on, and thank you for sharing your insights and experience with us.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
You bet. To our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe and leave your thoughts in the comments below. Don't miss our upcoming episodes every other Tuesday on Nursing Real Wealth, where we'll dive into more success stories and wealth building strategies. Have a great day. God bless.